Chapter 12. Homicide and Legitimacy. Victoria Beach was born in Seattle in 1959 and raised in the historically black Capitol Hill neighborhood downtown. "We have five generations here now in Seattle," she said. "My grandfather was an activist. He went to jail because they said he was a communist, which he wasn't. Dad was somewhat of an activist, too." Vicky remembers protests in the early 1970s. "I remember driving through a riot with the Black Panthers and getting tear gassed," she said. "My dad took all of us home. We lived a few blocks away and went back to fight the fight." Victoria Vicky Beach of Seattle is a different person than Victoria Vicky Westbrook of San Francisco. To avoid confusion, I will only refer to them by their first name when it is clear which one is being discussed. Vicky grew up hating the police. "My dad was an alcoholic and would beat up my mom," she said. "We would call the police. They would come and beat the crap out of my dad in front of us. Every single time. Back then, they could get away with stuff like that. And so I hated them." The violence continued when Vicky was a teenager. "One night, my brother and sister were going to go to the store, and we pushed the car to get it to start. Somebody called and said the car was being stolen. The police came, and they beat the crap out of my brother. My twin sister was screaming at them, 'You're going to kill him!' And they took her, beat her up, and arrested both of them. Some of our white friends were doing the same stuff, but they weren't addressed at all. I went up to the police car window to talk to my sister just to tell her, 'I'm going to call Mom, don't worry.' They threw me down and handcuffed me for talking to her. We kept saying, 'We're kids,' and they were like, 'No, you're not, you're going to jail.' The whole ride down there, being called N-word, it was like, 'They can't do that. They can't call us those names,' but it was like, 'Who's going to help? Nobody's going to do anything about it.'" Police violence against Vicky's family was intergenerational. "My daughter is 25 now, but when she was 5, she was in an incident," said Vicky. "I used to work graveyard, and so I would come home and sleep when her dad got home. My nephew was fixing the brakes in front of our house. A white friend of his and my ex-husband came up and said, 'We need to get a part for the car, we're going to leave, and I'm taking Maya with us,' and so they get up. I'm not too far from the East Precinct. They get close there and they're surrounded on every side by police cars with their guns pointed at them. My daughter and ex-husband were sitting in the back seat. Over the loudspeaker, the police are saying, 'One by one, get out with your hands up.' And they're all yelling, 'We have a 5-year-old in the back seat.' The police didn't care. They go, 'Get out with your hands up.' One by one, they get out and they're told to lay on their bellies. They all got out except my daughter. And when they got to the car, of course she wasn't going to get out. She had her hands up. A 5-year-old with her hands up. And they had guns pointed at her. She wasn't crying. Eventually they said, 'You can sit with your dad in the back seat, but he's handcuffed.' She was so traumatized by that," said Vicky. "She had to sleep with us. She said, 'They're going to kill us. They're in our basement.' We had her in counseling forever." In the spring of 2020, a white police officer in Minneapolis kneeled on the neck of a black man named George Floyd for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. A bystander filmed the event on her smartphone. 20 times Floyd said he could not breathe. Floyd pled for his mother, saying, "Please, please, please, and you're going to kill me, man." Floyd knew he was dying. "Mom, I love you, love you. Tell my kids I love them." He then said, "I'm dead." Within a few hours, the video had gone viral, triggering some of the largest protests in American history. In Washington, D.C. in 2020, protesters painted giant yellow letters on the street that spelled out, "Defund the police." In mid-June 2020, more than 1,000 protesters marched peacefully under the banner of Black Lives Matter from Mission High School to City Hall in San Francisco to demand the defunding of the police department. They shut down several freeway entrances, the Golden Gate Bridge, and the Bay Bridge. In Berkeley, a large crowd marched and chanted, "Abolish police," with drivers honking their support. "We want to disband police," said one organizer, "by any means necessary." Police in the United States kill at a rate of 3 people per day, for a total of nearly 1,000 deaths per year. Canada has the second highest rate of police killings in the world, at a rate one-third that of the United States. Black Americans are killed at between 2 to 3 times the rate of white Americans, according to a Washington Post analysis of police killings between 2015 and 2020. A total of 15,699 men, aged 15 to 34, died at the hands of law enforcement between 1960 and 2010, found researchers publishing in Harvard Public Health Review in 2015. Of those men, 55% were white and 42% were black. In that 50-year period, African Americans were killed by police at a rate 3 to 4 times higher than white Americans, according to the study. Higher rates of police killing cannot be explained by higher rates of violent crime by African Americans. And studies find that white people killed by the police are 57% more likely to be armed, and 13% less likely to be a threat to law enforcement as black people. A team of Harvard University researchers found in 2020 that police were 53% more likely to use non-lethal physical force on an African American than on a white American. They analyzed 5 million police encounters with civilians in New York City and a database of 1,316 police shootings of civilians between 2000 and 2015 in localities in California, Texas, Florida, and Colorado. But since that number was based on police reports alone, the actual number could be higher. A national survey found that black Americans were 350% more likely to have police use physical force on them than white Americans. "This is true of every level of non-lethal force," said Harvard economist Roland Fryer, who led the team, "from officers putting their hands on civilians to striking them with batons. We controlled for every variable available in myriad ways. That reduced the racial disparities by 66%, but black people were still significantly more likely to endure police force." One reason suggested for this is African Americans resisting arrest more than white people. But Fryer found that black people whom police recorded as compliant were still 21% more likely to suffer police violence. "This was perhaps our most upsetting result," said Fryer. "Compliance does make you less likely to endure a beatdown, but the benefit is larger if you are white." Aside from police killings, there is abundant evidence that the criminal justice system treats black people differently from white people. African Americans are more likely to not be told by police why they were pulled over, be treated with less respect by law enforcement, and have their cars searched after traffic stops, even though such stops turn up fewer weapons than do stops of white people. A 2020 study in Nature looked at 100 million traffic stops and found black people were more likely to be stopped during the day when their race was visible than at night, an indication of racial bias. Black adults are 5 times more likely than white people to say police have unfairly stopped them because of their race or ethnicity. African Americans are more likely to be wrongly convicted of murder, rape, and drug crimes, to be incarcerated longer for the same crimes, and to be convicted to life without parole for nonviolent offenses than white Americans. Black people are more likely to receive higher bail requirements for the same crime, to be offered plea bargains that include jail time, and to be incarcerated while waiting for trial than white people. And African Americans are more likely to be charged with low-level offenses, fined for jaywalking, and have their probation revoked than white people. Between 2010 and 2019, 79% of homicides with white victims were solved, compared to just 60% of homicides with African-American victims. One-third of U.S. states have never had a black state Supreme Court justice. Black judges are more likely to be overruled than white judges, and 95% of prosecutors and 85% of attorneys are white. 1 in 10 black men with a high school diploma was, by 2010, in jail or prison, while an astonishing 37% of African-American men who dropped out of high school were. There is significant unpunished racist conduct among police, an alarming prevalence of white supremacy in departments, and many reports of racism. Police unions often exert undue influence over local politicians, including demands for qualified immunity from prosecution for police shootings. And the blue wall of silence in many departments eerily reflects the culture of no snitching within many inner-city communities. Police unions have made it difficult for cities to hold officers accountable. Established in a backlash against the riots of the 1960s, unions added obstacles to disciplinary action in the form of binding arbitration, appeals processes, and an officer's Bill of Rights. A 2017 investigation by the Washington Post found that while 1,881 officers had been fired since 2006 for offenses including fraud, sexual assault, and unjustified shootings, over 450 were reinstated after appeals required by union contracts. A New York Times review of about 100 controversial police killings found that departments did not discipline or publicly disclose discipline in the majority of cases, with some departments refusing to answer basic questions or release records. One surprising finding by Harvard's Roland Fryer was that he and his research team didn't find racial differences between the use of lethal force by police after they accounted for whether the shootings or killings were justified or unjustified, which is something that the databases created by the Washington Post and other media organizations did not do. In Fryer's data, around 20% of police shootings are considered unjustified because the person did not attack, draw a weapon, or otherwise make the officer feel at risk of bodily harm. Fryer found no evidence of higher rates of police shootings of African Americans than white people when the suspect is stopped by police. When using the simple statistical framework that economists have used for more than a half century to analyze racial differences on myriad dimensions, from wages to incarceration to teen pregnancy, wrote Fryer, the evidence for racial bias disappears. The findings of Fryer might be easier to dismiss if he weren't black and doing research in service of reducing police violence. For all of us who are frustrated about decades of racial disparities that have gone unchecked, wrote Fryer, this is our Gettysburg. Yet we do ourselves a disservice in the battle against racial inequality if we don't adhere to rigorous standards of evidence, if we cherry-pick data based on our preconceptions. Others, using different data sets, came to similar conclusions. The nonpartisan Center for Policing Equity found that police killings are rare, that black Americans face higher rates of non-lethal force, and that racial disparities are smaller in lethal use of force. And the authors of the 2015 Harvard Public Health Review study concluded, we cannot, based on the limited data available, address debates over whether our findings reflect racially biased use of excessive force. A big part of the reason social scientists can't say whether police unjustly kill black Americans at higher rates than others is that police departments lack a uniform protocol for reporting victim demographics and encounter characteristics. Fryer notes that, until recently, data on officer-involved shootings were extremely rare and contained little information on the details surrounding an incident. Violent interactions with police and civilians are rare events. On average, between 2000 and 2020, 1,481 people were killed nationally by police per year, about 0.5 per 100,000. Those numbers for the police departments of New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco were 17, 24, and 4, respectively. Among those killed whose race was known, 29% were black and 71% were non-black, compared to 13.6% black and 86.4% non-black in the general population. That African Americans are disproportionately killed by police is evident from these numbers alone. What is more difficult to discern is whether this reflects the reality that black people are more likely to end up in a situation that involves lethal force, or whether it reflects racial bias, a targeting of black people above and beyond the requirements of just policing and public safety. A rigorous measure of racial bias would require regulated and more transparent incident reporting by police departments. In the end, Fryer could only use data from Houston to measure racial bias and differences in justified lethal force. Racism may explain the findings, but the statistical evidence doesn't prove it, said Fryer. Other studies have attempted to analyze differences across U.S. counties, using whether suspects were unarmed as a shortcut for estimating whether force was unjust, but have still failed to find differences in shootings of white and black Americans that hold up in margins of error. The bottom line, notes Brandon Vaidyanathan of Catholic University, is that none of the data on police shootings can tell us whether racial bias is a motivating factor. In 2019, Chase Aboud-Din won an underdog campaign against opposition from the city's police union, the Police Officers Association, to become San Francisco's district attorney. I was consistently the furthest left candidate in the race, said Boudin. And a lot of other folks said, well, this is not going to work. The POA is going to spend money again. They spent $700,000 attacking me in a 10-day period at the end of the race, as much as we spent the whole year on our campaign. Boudin is today one of the leading voices for a progressive approach to criminal justice. Right now we have a criminal justice system that's really, really good at punishing people, he said in 2020. It's really bad at healing the harm that crime causes, and it's really bad at preventing future crime. In fact, it perpetuates cycles of crime. I know that because I grew up visiting my own parents in prison. I've been impacted my whole life. The election of Boudin is the culmination of work by a criminal justice movement that has, alongside the movement against the war on drugs, sought to draw attention to the disparate impact of America's criminal justice system on people of color, particularly African Americans, a cause I have long cared about. In 2000, I committed civil disobedience at a protest organized by criminal justice advocate and, today, CNN talk show host Van Jones at an Oakland police station. The initiative we were protesting, Proposition 21, increased the punishment of juvenile offenders by expanding the circumstances where juveniles can be tried in adult court, reduced the discretion of probation departments, and increased sentencing length for gang-related crimes. It passed with 62% of the vote. But much of what I believed back then turned out to not be true, or at least wasn't the whole truth. We already saw that just 14% of state prisoners are nonviolent, low-level drug offenders, that 90% of all prisoners in the United States are in state, not federal prisons, and that many trends are going in the right direction. That also goes for police violence. Police killings of African Americans declined from 217 per year in the 1970s to 157 per year in the 2010s in the 58 largest U.S. cities. Police killings of all races in New York declined dramatically, from an average of 59 per year between 1970 and 1975 to an average of 12 per year between 2015 and 2020, even as its population increased. In San Francisco and Oakland, the rate of police killings per year increased slightly, going from 2.7 and 2.8 per year respectively in the 1970s, to 2.4 and 3.9 per year in the 2010s. But police killings per capita in the two cities declined by 8.3%. While many police departments need to do a better job, it is also the case that police departments have improved markedly over the last 50 years. Racism in police departments persists, but there is now more representation of Black Americans among officers and commissioners, and many police departments have seen significant reforms in recent years. Use of force by the San Francisco Police Department declined by nearly half between 2016 and 2020. In 2020, the New York Times described San Francisco as a place where police reform has worked to reduce killings. "What we're talking about is significant cultural change in the department," said a former lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union. While racial disparities persist, racism and police violence is today heavily outweighed by other much larger factors, such as the degree to which police have been properly trained and managed, and the power of police unions to block necessary reforms. In fact, there is wide variation between American counties when it comes to racial disparities in the rate of police shootings, and those differences could not be attributed to different crime rates. "Does racism play a role?" asks Frank Zimring, a criminologist who has been studying and writing about homicides for more than 50 years. "You bet. Is it the dominant force in explaining American lethal violence by police? No." Why then did so many of us come to believe that police killings were rising and that racism was the main motivation behind them? Smartphones and the internet, combined with the fact that videos of white police officers and black victims are more likely to be shared than ones of black officers and white victims, appear to be a big part of the reason. The problem with such videos is that they aren't representative of police use of force. "Our analysis tells us what happens on average," noted Fryer. "It isn't average when a police officer casually kneels on someone's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. The impact of such videos is strong, especially among people who have had negative experiences with the police." "I wish to God I didn't watch that video," said Vicky about the George Floyd video. "When stuff like that happens, I flip so quick back to the other side where I hate police. It's just, oh, I hate them. I'm not going to help them." Carmen Best was born in Tacoma, Washington in 1965 and joined the Seattle Police Department after 2 years in the military. She loved police work. "I liked it if I caught a car prowler," she said, "or if it was gang activity, knowing who the players were, where their homes were. Being able to help people in domestic violence and child protective situations." In 2018, Best interviewed for the job of chief of police. The hiring committee selected by the Seattle City Council seemed hostile. "It felt like the committee really just did not want me to be the chief. It felt unfair, but I was like, okay, well, it wasn't meant to be. I'm just going to move on." A member of the search committee told a local reporter that they wanted a candidate from outside the police force. But when Seattle residents, both black and white, found out that Best would not get the job, they organized politically. "Community members came from everywhere and just would not accept it," she said. "The next thing I knew, the hiring committee said, hey, we'd like you to put your name back in as a contender for the job." Best had a mandate to expand and diversify the police department. "The community really wanted more cops," she said. "At least 3 city council members campaigned on more cops. They wanted better response times." And so Best created a plan with the former mayor and previous chief to increase the number of officers, but also to really try to have a lot more diversity with our hiring, for women and people of color both. We got to about almost 40% of either minority or women representation as new hires. Then 2020 arrived. There was a mass shooting in downtown Seattle, she said. 8 people injured, 2 deceased. It was a battle between rival gangs to control the open-air drug market. Just when we were working through all of that, COVID hit. Seattle is one of the first major agencies to have to deal with it. It was 18-hour days for days on end. There wasn't no roadmap. We just had to work through it and figure it out. Then the killing of George Floyd happened. Because of COVID-19, Best said, a lot more people had the availability to come out and to engage in what happened to George Floyd, which was quite beautiful. But a small group of people within the crowd started to behave violently. Within that large group of people who were there peacefully protesting, there were groups there to create mayhem, throw rocks, bottles, and incendiary stuff, and point lasers at the officers. Vicky confronted violent protesters after she saw them light a car on fire and vandalize stores. I got in the faces of all these white kids writing Black Lives Matter, breaking windows at Nordstrom's, spray painting. My daughter was like, Mom, they're going to beat you up. But I told them, this isn't what we're about. Why are you doing this? It was a lot of white kids, and I was just like, the black community is going to get blamed for this. Then, in June, somebody removed a police barricade that had prevented demonstrators from protesting in front of the East Precinct downtown. It was decided, said Best, I'll put it that way, to remove the barricade and to allow the demonstrators to fill in the street in front of the precinct. We didn't want to give up the precinct. I have to tell you, it was not my decision. Police officers inside the East Precinct building feared the protesters would throw Molotov cocktails through the windows and set the building on fire. And so they began removing items from the precinct in case it caught on fire or was overrun by protesters. The next morning, there were these folks out there armed with long rifles, telling the officers who responded that it was their sovereign land, said Best. What sovereign property are they talking about? Well, they're talking about 12th Avenue, she laughs. We had never experienced anything like that. And therein began CHAZ, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. Later, the organizers would rename the area CHOP for Capitol Hill Occupied Protest. The anarchist leaders invited hundreds of Seattle's homeless residents to move into the occupied zone, and many did. When asked, Seattle's mayor insisted that everything would work out fine. How long do you think Seattle and those few blocks looks like this? CNN's Chris Cuomo asked Seattle's mayor. I don't know, she replied. We could have a summer of love. After she called it summer of love is when all hell broke loose, said Vicky. That's when they took over. And it was a battle every single night. They had hundreds of tents on the street and were living in front of the police department. Women were raped in there more than once. 2 young black men were murdered up there. It was crazy chaos up there. I can't believe more people didn't die. Guns were in the wrong hands. A lot of mentally ill people had weapons, Vicky said. There was one guy who had 3 guns, an assault rifle and 2 handguns. He was batshit crazy. He wanted to shoot somebody. Every black person that I saw come up there was like, they don't represent us. They're not representing Black Lives Matter. This is a whole other whatever. This has got to end. The CHOP crowd was 98 or 99% white. They don't even live in Seattle. They hit a police officer in the back of the head with a baseball bat, and the one who did it goes, I wish he didn't have a helmet on. As a representative of the Capitol Hill community, Vicky felt compelled to stand up to the anarchists. You're not going to do this in my neighborhood, she shouted. How dare you disrespect George Floyd and his family? We don't protest like this. Stop using Black Lives Matter to tear up the city. Vicky at one point shoved a protester. I got to my breaking point where enough was enough, she said. A girl flipped me off and called me a few names and I lost it. I just shoved her. I'm not proud of that action, but I'm not sorry either. Afterward, Vicky learned from sources that the anarchists were targeting her for violence. I got a phone call from a woman and she goes, "There's a bullseye on your back." Seattle's mayor told Vicky that the police were monitoring potential threats to her life. Best started reading about anarchism to understand what she was dealing with. In some of the literature on anarchy, she said, they talk about having autonomous zones. Very soon it was a lawless area. They were barricading themselves in. I went there myself twice on my own. I walked in and somebody tried to stop me. She said, "What are you doing?" I was in uniform. She's like, "Where do you think you're going?" And I said, "I'm going to walk down the street. And that's what I'm going to do." I mean, it was just like the craziest thing ever. Some of the city staff were talking to the occupiers. But that really wasn't working well either because they were enablers, bringing in porta-potties, handing out hand sanitizers, letting them tear up the park to build a vegetable farm, memorializing the graffiti. All of it seemed counterproductive to public safety. Soon, the police started to get reports of crimes. We were getting reports of rape, robbery, assault. I wasn't making it up, said Best. These things were happening in a zone where it was very dangerous. There were people there who were armed. There's video out there. You can see them shooting up in there. I don't know what the Wild West was like, but it couldn't have been any worse than that. Best and her team saw other ominous signs. We knew many of them were armed. We'd seen them practicing, linking arms around the facility to try to keep officers out. We fully expected there to be a significant amount of resistance to moving people out of that area. Some of the CHOP leaders haven't always been winners in life. Now they've got CNN and Fox interviewing them. They've got a mission. They suddenly feel connected to this area, and in a way that they probably never in their lives had been, which meant that they were probably going to try quite hard to hang on. Seattle's mayor and city council started to change their tune after the first person was murdered, said Best. They realized, oh, maybe this isn't as safe as we thought it might be. Then everybody was panicking. I was like, I've been telling you for weeks we need to get this thing shut down. It was bad. Best told reporters the police would retake CHOP. Two African-American men are dead at a place where they claim to be working for Black Lives Matter. Enough is enough. We need to be able to get back into the area. Any meaningful effort to protect Black lives should aim to reduce homicides overall, not just homicides by police officers. 30 times more African Americans were killed by civilians than by police in 2019. San Francisco's homicide victimization rate from 2009 to 2019 was, on average, 6 per 100,000, and was 49% Black and 19% white non-Hispanic. In the same 10-year period, Oakland's homicide victimization rate averaged 23 per 100,000, and was 74% Black and 10% white non-Hispanic. No one should be satisfied with those numbers, and yet there is remarkably little debate over how to lower them. It is reasonable to ask whether homicides are really a concern given declining homicide and prison rates over the past 2 decades. The total U.S. prison and jail population peaked in 2008 and has declined ever since. Between 2008 and 2019, the total U.S. and California incarcerated population declined from 2,390,000 to 2,165,000 and from 250,000 to 196,000, respectively. The incarceration rate of the United States and California declined from 782 per 100,000 to 660 per 100,000, and from 690 per 100,000 to 497 per 100,000, respectively, between 2006 and 2019. But the United States has the highest rate of homicide of any developed nation. The homicide rate in the United States is 4 times as high as that of France and Britain, and more than 5 times higher than Australia's. Scholars have studied racial disparity in homicides for as long as it has existed. In Philadelphia, between 1948 and 1952, scholars found black men died from homicide at 12 times the rate of white men. A national survey found the same difference in 1950. Today, black Americans are 7 to 8 times more likely to die from homicide than white Americans. In 2019, the homicide rate for white people was 2.3 per 100,000, whereas it was 17.4 for black people. And in 2020, in the wake of summer protests against police violence, the homicide rate increased on average by more than one-third in America's 57 largest cities. Homicides rose in 51 cities and declined just in 6 of them. Homicides rose 35% in Los Angeles, 31% in Oakland, 74% in Seattle, 63% in Portland, 60% in Chicago, and 47% in New York. The coronavirus pandemic may have played a role. Gangs are built around structure and lack thereof, noted a Fresno, California police officer. With schools being closed and a lot of different businesses being closed, the people that normally would have been involved in positive structures in their lives aren't there. But there had been a similar spike in homicides in 2015, when there was no coronavirus pandemic. Back then, as in 2020, a disproportionate number of victims and suspects were black men under 30 from poor, inner-city neighborhoods. Rivalries among organized street gangs, often over drug turf, noted Two Times reporters in 2015, and the availability of guns are cited as major factors in some cities. But more commonly, many top police officials say they are seeing a growing willingness among disenchanted young men in poor neighborhoods to use violence to settle ordinary disputes. After the spike in homicides in 2020, some pointed to higher gun sales, which rose in March at the beginning of the pandemic. But homicides in 2020 only started to rise in June, not March. In truth, young men, street gangs, and large numbers of handguns have existed in American society for hundreds of years, and over periods where homicides declined, such as in the early 1990s. And there was little evidence to suggest that any of those variables had changed suddenly or dramatically enough in 2015 or 2020 to account for the homicide spikes. What then was going on?